Chad, it's great to see you again.
It is wonderful to see you again, and thank you. I'm so excited that we picked the right shed.
I know. It'd be so awkward if we were just waiting in separate sheds.
It would be, and I would probably wait for a really long time thinking that I was right.
And waiting for me to admit that I was wrong.
Exactly. Well, she'll be here in a second, even though we didn't really discuss which shed. Clearly, I'm right.
Neither one of us is as brilliant as Giraud, who knows all about sheds.
He certainly does. And what a great invitation and segue there to Chapter 8 of Murder on the Links.
Okay, I have to say, Murder on the Links makes me feel like I am getting the closest I'll ever be as a human to knowing what it's like to be inside a black hole. Very small amount of space, a lot of dense matter.
Yeah, and you feel like your entire body elongating.
Uh-huh, yeah. I'm like breaking apart and getting smaller all at the same time.
Exactly.
Anyways, so we're here together. And we are going to talk about Chapter 8 and do it justice.
I don't know how you do Chapter 8 justice, honestly. But
okay. Why don't you take us through, like, generally what happens?
Yes. An unexpected meeting, Chapter 8 of Murder on the Links. And we go through a couple of different testimony gathering situations here with Perot and Hastings. And that's totally great. But then we have this weird thing that happens I'd say about halfway through the chapter, where Hastings, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he bumps into Cinderella, who is the woman from chapter one that he had met on the train. And they have this conversation. And what ends up happening is that Hastings boasts, I believe, about that, you know, did you hear about the, you know, the murder, blah, blah, blah. I'm kind of part of the investigation or whatever. And Cinderella goes, oh my gosh, could I see the crime scene? Could I see the body? And Hastings says, yes.
Of course you can go to this crime scene. Let me show you around.
Let me, a non-licensed person who has nothing to do with investigating crime, bring you, a complete stranger to the case, in theory, to see the body.
Let's go look at a dead person who has been festering in this overly hot shed.
Which we are standing next to.
Which we are,
yes, smelly.
So weird,
It's a little gross right now. But it is pure Hastings nonsense.
So first, like, as Poirot is doing some questioning, he is asking Léonie some questions, and she works at the house. And she's giving us updates about Madame Renaud, who has seen the body, and she has fainted. She's totally upset. She's not eating anything. And Poirot's like, that's interesting, because if Monsieur Renaud was like maybe having an affair, or maybe they'd been arguing, right? What's going on? And Léonie's like, no, they had such a good relationship. They would never argue. And then she lets an interesting thing slip. She's like, no, they had a great relationship, which again, to Poirot was like, this is a little weird. That doesn't really sound like the relationship of someone who's having an affair. But Léonie is then like, she is so chill compared to Monsieur Renaud, especially after he argued with his son Jack recently. And Poirot's like, okay, slow down. Let's elaborate. What argument with Jack? And Jack is his son. And we learn that Jack was super mad at Monsieur Renaud, his father. They had a big argument right before he left for Paris.
I believe it's about Martha.
Martha.
Yes.
I'm thinking about that YouTube video we watched.
Martha.
Jack is falling for her. He wants to marry her. But of course, you cannot marry a woman with questionable antecedents. So they have a huge fight. Then the International Crime Fighting Club, they're like, let's go look in the garage. Let's go look in the where they keep the cars. And Poirot is like, go have fun. So this is where Hastings He's like kind of rambling through the hedges again.
That's right. There's hedge rambling.
He's like, I want to look at the golf course because it's so beautiful. And there's like a beautiful little overlook. And so he's kind of just like making his way through the little like trees and kind of separating greenery kind of in between all the properties. That's where he runs into Cinderella. She's snooping. She's snooping already. They're both kind of snooping. They're meant for each other.
Neither of them detectives.
No. Both of them just meddlers. He's like, I'm here for a crime scene. And she's like, oh my God, so cool. Agatha Christie says, her breast heaved. Her eyes grew wide and round. And then she says, tote me around. I want to see all the horrors. She's so jazzy.
She's very jazzy. Yeah, definitely. But that is so great that Agatha Christie is making us aware of Hastings being aware of the reaction that Cinderella is clearly having intentionally to be like, get me to the crime scene.
And it's so funny because Hastings is just like, oh, I don't like her at all. She's so dark. He's like, how unladylike. But he's like, sure, I'll show you anyways.
Right. He is also definitely showing off to her.
Yeah. He says, where does he say? I turned away sickened. What were women coming to nowadays? The girl's ghoulish excitement nauseated me. And then she calls him out on it, which is great. She's like, don't give yourself airs. You'd be doing the exact same thing. And this is what you are doing. She's like, you're literally just getting excitement or getting joy and getting pleasure out of following people around solving a crime. And Hastings is like, well, I'm a man and you're a woman. He literally says that. And I think there's some Agatha Christie in her here. Cinderella says, your idea of a woman is someone who gets on a chair and shrieks if she sees a mouse. That's prehistoric.
Cinderella is saying to Hastings, listen, you and I are the same, but she has an ulterior motive.
Yeah.
So that's how much that she is using Hastings, so much exactly. That she's not only with the heaving bosom and stuff, but she's also then like, you know what, we're thick as thieves on this.
She thinks that her sister is involved somehow. At this point, she doesn't know in what way, but she knows her sister was at the house the night of the crime. And then she can't find her sister. So she's like, I'm going to do everything I can to protect my sister, even though I don't know the whole story, which is where things even get more muddled.
Right.
And Hastings admits to us, he's like, secretly, I knew that I should rather enjoy the part of the showman. And it's like, of course. Okay. Way to be really self-aware there. So he's showing her around and she's like, what if we saw the shed? What if we saw the body? And he's like, that's not weird at all. And so he like asks one of the police officers, he's like, hey, could I get the key to the shed where the dead body?
I have just a quick thing real quickly. Uh-huh. Maybe this is like some type of weird kink for Hastings because he's like, you want to see the body? That's disgusting, you hot little, like he's like, it's this he's weird
like,
thing.
He's like, how dare you? I love it. Okay. And you're just... So he feels so important because he's like, I can go to a police officer and they'll give me the key because I have all of the freedom to investigate that Poirot does. He even says, he's like, in this moment, I felt equal to Poirot, which is like nice imagination there.
The reason he feels like he's Poirot is because he's bringing someone to the body. In no way, shape, or form is he as good a detective or as accomplished.
He gets perks. Like he, I think, would like do so well in like an entourage of some kind to like some kind of celebrity where he can just like live that lifestyle but have zero talent. That is like the Hastings dream.
Give me Hastings in Entourage and that's it.
Hastings is being dumb here. Like, imagine if she were the murderer. This is what Agatha Christie wants us to kind of think. Not only are they in the shed with a dead body, but Hastings is like, what if I turn the body over and show you the knife wound? In what world would that be a good idea?
I genuinely felt that he was in a game of one-upmanship with her. Okay, so we're here. Here's the body. Do you want me to turn it over? Mm-hmm. So you can see that he's literally playing right into her hands.
And so then she this whole time is like, okay, I need to get him out so I can tamper with the evidence. So he shows her the knife that killed Monsieur Renaud. And she's like, oh my gosh, I feel so faint. So she like faints and she's like, get help, get me some water. So he just leaves her in the shed.
When she faints, it's such a masterful way of playing Hastings because he's like, told you so. Told you you didn't want to see this body.
He comes back and then he's so pleased too that he gets to take care of her because that's all he wants to do is like take care of a helpless woman. And he thinks to himself, I felt this to be so feminine that I could forbear a smile. Secretly, I was not dissatisfied with her collapse. And then again, he's like, in this moment, she was so childlike, which like made me feel so good.
Yeah.
Hastings, to be his therapist, to dive into the intricacies that are Hastings' mind.
I would be so interested in understanding Hastings' shadow self that it would just be like, oh man, okay, you saw some stuff in the war and you're also this, and oh my God.
Anybody who wants to like write some fan fiction about that, please let us know. So then he's like, I'm going to be a gentleman. You are so weak. I'll walk you home. And she's like, no, you don't really need to. And he's like, but I insist. And she's like, but I insist. So then eventually they compromise that he'll walk her partway home. She does not want in any way for him to know where she's staying. He accidentally leaves the shed unlocked the entire time. So then he goes back and he like kind of quietly locks the shed and gives the key back to the police officer. And that's where we end this very, very special chapter. Okay, so let's go to chapter 9. I love even like in this title how it's kind of condescending because it says Monsieur Giraud finds some clues. So like we know it's just going to be useless clues, but we're going to like let him have his moment to think that he's come up with something.
Yeah, it's pretty much just another sort of little bit of a competitive chapter between Poirot and Giraud, where we kind of understand now the difference in their methods. And Poirot, as the book goes on, starts to become more and more direct with Giraud. He becomes like a little less like, what are you doing? Do you not see this? Instead, he starts to become just like, no. I know what I'm doing. You don't.
This is the most assertive we've seen Poirot so far.
Certainly the least polite we have seen him.
Oh, something that was really interesting too is learning more about the tension between Hôté and Giraud, because there's this tension between the local police and then the Parisian city boy kind of coming in. So there's that clash too. Yeah. So like Giraud's, he starts things off by saying something really snarky about how Hôté is conducting an interrogation of Auguste, the gardener, by an open window. And he's like, I would never do that because anyone can hear what you're saying. So he's like already dissing Hôté. And then Giraud is like, well, I found something outside. And he pulls out a match and a cigarette. And Poirot, like kind of in the corner, is like, this literally tells us nothing, Giraud. And Giraud is like, but this match and the cigarette are from South America. So there's like some snarky back and forth about like whether this is important. And Poirot basically says, like, isn't it weird that the criminals didn't bring anything else of their own? They had to use all the tools from the house, but they, like, brought these specific items and dropped them. Then Giraud, he kind of is like, well, I have my own theory. And Poirot critiques him, saying, like, well, in your theory, you know how that front door was opened, but you do not explain why it stayed open. And so Giraud is like ignoring certain things to fit his theory.
Yes.
I feel like this book is almost a lesson in just like how to think logically too, and like how to think critically. It's like we can't just like force these gaps closed. We have to rethink our ideas once we get a piece of evidence that doesn't fit them.
Oh, totally. And it's also, Poirot is endlessly curious. It's easy to think as you're reading this that he knows everything, but he doesn't. But what he's doing is employing a certain way of thinking about it, which is just like active listening and active curiosity, instead of immediately coming to a reason that the door would still be open and then being like, it's not important. Just like, no, but the door was still open and that in itself is important. It's a really great way of, I don't know, I'm just like going around with your life, basically, just being curious all the time. Yeah.
And also just like not ignoring things that challenge your perception or your worldview. It's like, now I have to revise my thoughts. So yeah, and Poirot is like getting pretty mad, mad about this. You know, Giraud is like, the door doesn't matter. And Poirot, he speaks in italics here. Mm-hmm. He says, I do not agree with you. The door being left open was a result of either design or necessity. And any theory that does not admit that fact is bound to prove vain. And everybody in the room is like, oh no, this is so awkward. This is so not what Poirot is usually like. He's having an outburst. Like, what's going on? Everybody's uncomfortable.
Right. And I think there's also the feeling that a lot of them have is like, Giraud is getting the best of Poirot here. Because everyone's kind of falling behind with like, oh my gosh, the match and the cigarette and la 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 la. And I'm not entirely sure Poirot's motivation. I like to think of it more as that he can't believe that this dude is thinking this way, that Giraud is this, rather than that people are, but he is also somewhat vain, Poirot. So who knows?
It's both. He's like, you are so dumb, but I'm so smart. And like, why doesn't anybody notice? After this outburst, and everybody kind of feels like embarrassed on Poirot's behalf a little bit, like how humiliating for him. He's like, not only are you wrong, Giraud, but this a crime almost precisely similar has been committed before. And I think we would be remiss if we didn't read a little bit of his speech about method. Poirot suddenly assumed his lecturing manner and addressed us collectively. I am speaking to you now of the psychology of crime. Monsieur Giraud knows quite well that each criminal has a particular method, that the police, when called in to investigate, say, a case of burglary, can often make a shrewd guess at the offender, simply by the particular methods he has employed. Man is an unoriginal animal, and this is really important later on, when Renaud unconsciously copies the same crime. Mm-hmm. Unoriginal within the law in his daily respectable life, equally unoriginal outside of the law. If a man commits a crime, any other crime he commits will resemble it closely. The English murderer who disposed of his wives in succession by drowning them in their baths was case in point. Had he varied his methods, he might have escaped detection to this day. But he obeyed the common dictate of human nature, arguing that what has once succeeded would succeed again, and he paid the penalty of his lack of originality. And Giraud's like, what's the point of all this, Poirot? And he says, lastly, that when you have two crimes precisely similar in design and execution, you find the same brain behind both. I am looking for that brain, Monsieur Giraud. I shall find it. Here we have a true clue, a psychological clue. You may know all about cigarettes and match ends, Monsieur Giraud, but I, Hercule Poirot, know the mind of man. So he's just like, everybody is looking in the wrong place.
That was a lovely reading. And
thank you.
And it also put me in the mindset as we stand here by the shed that had I been standing there hearing Poirot say that, I would have been like, this dude's lost his marbles.
Yeah.
He's already gotten angry at Giraud, and now he just goes off on this very elegant and loquacious thing that makes no sense to anyone. It comes out of absolutely nowhere.
And what this really is doing is this is priming us for the Baraldi case, which we will get to in like 5 chapters. But basically, the sense that this crime, this almost nearly exact crime, has been committed before, and Madame Debray and Monsieur Renaud were key figures in this, which is what has caused this whole kerfuffle. This chapter ends with Poirot saying that the most important thing that we need to think about that Giraud can't explain is why the watch was set 2 hours ahead. He's like, and Giraud, what do you make of the footprints in the flower bed? And Giraud is like, there aren't any footprints in the flower bed. Poirot's like, exactly. And Giraud's just like, oh my God, throwing my hat on the ground, walking away. Like, I am so frustrated by all this nonsense. The next couple of chapters, we get more information from the lawyer. Then we meet Jack Renaud. And then kind of like Poirot starts to get some theories. And then really, I feel like things kind of turn on their heads 5 chapters from now once we get the Baraldi case. So a lot of what we're about to go over is just like, everything is getting more complicated, and the more details we're adding here make things make less and less sense. And also the finger starts pointing to different people. Like Jack is starting to sound more and more suspicious. So let's get into it. So chapter 10, we have, is he, and I want to say, I either want to say his name, Gabrielle Stoner or Gabriel Stoner, depending on if he's, is he British? Yeah.
I think he's British.
Okay. From, so we'll call him Gabriel Stoner then.
Is he the lawyer or secretary or?
Yeah. So he's the secretary to Monsieur Renaud. So like he's close to the family. He knows all the business dealings of Monsieur Renaud.
He knows like where the money goes.
And okay. I just have to say the first paragraph of this chapter is just wasted introducing all of the detectives and all of the people in the room. And that's this moment where I'm like, there are just way too many people that we have to like waste a paragraph being like, Gabriel Stoner, meet so-and-so, meet Bex, meet Ote.
That's
meet
right. Blah, blah,
blah, and like explain everyone. And I was just like, oh my God, there's so many people in this room.
Then that's an amazing point. Cause I think that maybe this was the first or second chapter of one of the four parts that was released.
So smart. Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's right. Here are all the characters again.
That makes sense then why we slow down. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you're totally right that probably chapter 9 was the end of something because we get a climax a little bit. We get this huge argument. Poirot is so upset. And then things kind of quiet down again and we go into info gathering.
There are always these different things that are added on to each potential quarter of it that make you want to continue to read it.
Yeah.
And one of the last one was that there's potentially an entirely different case that needs to be looked into.
So true.
Yeah. And so then now we start with also like a different perspective of evidence with this Gabriel Stoner, who has definitive things to say about different monetary issues with Renaud.
Basically, what we learn here is that Stoner didn't know that Poirot was sent for. So that's also kind of this lingering question is, you know, Madame Renaud didn't know, Stoner didn't know. So there's like this huge question mark around like Poirot's presence. Stoner is pretty much flabbergasted. He doesn't really understand why Monsieur Renaud would be murdered. There's no like big secret in South America or Santiago. There's no big secret there. There's no drama. And Stoner, just like Leonie, is like, no, there's no other woman. Monsieur Renaud did not have a roving eye at all. But then they're like, but the letter from Bella is definitive proof of the affair because it was in his pocket. And Stoner, he doubles down. He's like, you guys are way off. No, whatever that is, that's not his mistress.
Right. And I think there's also a thing where this person who knows and had worked intimately with Paul Renaud on finances, and this guy, and Renaud is extremely wealthy. So Stoner is an important dude. And he just says that he doesn't really know anything about Renaud's past.
Yeah. And that's mysterious.
Especially in the context of what we learned at the end of chapter nine, about there being a whole other case potentially that has to be looked into from the past. And we also know nothing about Renaud's past.
But the crowd of detectives, they're like, aha, but what about Madame Dubray and all the large amounts of money that Monsieur Renaud was giving her? Like, what else could it be? It has to be this affair. And Stoner is like, no, there's definitely another option. She was probably blackmailing him. Collective gasp. The detective club also asks about a will. I think we've mentioned this before. The original will, half was supposed to go to Monsieur Renaud's wife, Madame Renaud. Half was supposed to go to Jack. And like a little bit was going to go to Stoner as a like, thanks for doing all my money stuff. That was drawn up a year and a half ago. But then the police reveal that a couple weeks ago, all the money was going to go to Madame Renaud. And Stoner's like, well, you know, I'm surprised, but that also proves that like Madame Renaud and Monsieur Renaud were on really good terms because like if they were having any kind of conflict, why would he then move all of his money to her? Like that's a big sign of trust.
If they were having an affair and they're arguing all the time, why would Mrs. Renaud get all of the money?
And the detectives are like, well, you know what? When we hear back from Santiago, everything will be explained. Then Madame Renaud comes in. She looks awful. She's clearly mourning. They ask her about Monsieur's Renaud's background. And she's like, I don't know, but I think he came from like the Pacific Northwest in Canada. So go us. But that's all she knows. Okay. Then we get a plot twist, though, because Stoner is like, they're asking me these dumb questions about an affair with Madame Dubray. And Madame Renaud gets really upset. And Stoner is like, what is going on? Like, this is so uncharacteristic. And Madame Renaud says, yes, maybe they were having an affair. And Stoner is like, jaw dropped. We end the chapter.
When you go through it like that, it is fascinating because it's almost a reversal of what had been happening during the evidence gathering in the previous chapters. Almost everything Stoner is saying is completely factual. But then when Madame Renaud comes down, she casts some type of doubt on the concept that it could be blackmail.
We know now that she was lying to get them off the scent because she doesn't want anybody to know that Monsieur Renaud is not who he says he is. He's actually Georges Queneau. And so when they're asking her all these questions about his past, she's like, this is too close. I need to really like throw them off the scent, even if that means tarnishing some of his memory to preserve the entire secret.
Okay, I just want to really quickly take a second here because I'm going to look at that. So it's 49.50. That entire thing you just did right there,
yeah.
I am going to isolate and I think we're going to play it at the beginning of one of the episodes to just show how obscenely complex the story is.
Okay.
Because now we're both talking about it like it's matter of fact. But taking a step back, I was like, what the fuck is going on? Like, that was great.
Yeah, I feel like this book has become a competitive sport. I don't know who we're competing against. I feel like maybe it's the book.
I'm competing against myself. When we were talking about Giraud there, I was like, did Agatha Christie put Giraud in because she understood that there were readers who now understand that everything Hastings thinks is going to be wrong? So is Christie turning the reader into Giraud? This concept where like now we're more like have to take his stuff potentially seriously, at least on the first read. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I think I'm competing with my own dumb guesses throughout this book.
Yes. Yeah. And like, this is a marathon that we are running. No one else is competing. We're just trying to see if we can like survive it, I feel like, and if our brains can actually do this. And when we're done, I don't know, I'm going to be a new person. I'm going to believe in myself more. I'm going to have more confidence.
This recording about this book has already made me more excited to read the next ones.
Yes.
Because now I'm starting to see Poirot as this kind of very fussy person with all these idiosyncrasies. But his basic mindset is one of expanding things to see the whole picture, which I'm a huge fan of.
That's so true. I feel like I've been running into this in like just lots of different areas of my life recently, where like to not look at something in all of its complexities is to just live life. I don't know. Okay, I don't want to, like, how do I say this? It is at the detriment of everyone. You are creating victims when you do not like look at things and hold these like you're also like not examining yourself, I feel like.
I totally agree with you. And the way that I look at that too is that even if you get yourself in the most sort of the place where you're like, I'm always going to be curious, you are never, ever going to be curious enough to know all the complexities of all of the situations with all the people in your life. So why not try? Because if you do the opposite, you are just being really disrespectful to the people in the situation.
Yeah, it's like living in a constant state of self-defense too. Kind of like Giraud is everybody's like, well, I've got to defend my thing because I've got to be right, you know?
Yeah, I have to be the authority.
Yeah.
It's very important.
You're like constantly on guard, like defending your ideas. It's just that thing of like, do you want to be perceived as right and smart or do you want to actually be right?
Yeah, and that's the whole thing is that thing, that great part at the end of chapter 9, where there's a big difference between Poirot saying, do you not see this as a possibility? And Giraud cutting everything off and being like, absolutely not.
Exactly, yeah.
Totally different philosophies on life.
Oh my God, Agatha Christie, what are you doing to us?
What is going on? What is happening?
I'm coming out of this smarter and wiser.
Yeah, I don't know. I might just give away all my possessions and live on the beach after this. I don't know.
On a beach in France?
Yeah, on a French beach.
Yep. Next to a golf course?
There's a tall man down there with long hair and a beard who speaks no French. We should probably get him some food.
Yeah, we're concerned. He's just living in like a shack made out of Poirot books.
Right, that's all he does now.
Get this man help. Oh my God. Okay.
Chapter 11, Caitlin. Oh boy, here we go. This is Jack Renaud. This is Paul Renaud's son, who was sent to Santiago by his father, but as we will find out later, did not make the trip. And this is one of the things that I think is very subtly done by Agatha Christie in this. And I'm not, in no way, shape, or form am I shaming anyone in this, but in a very real way, Jack Renaud is kind of a man about town.
He
is someone who definitely is dating more than one person and is involved in different relationships. And these, I mean, we are learned to believe that one of them, Bella, Cinderella's sister, actually has really deep feelings for Jack and that Jack then has them for her, although it takes a little while to figure that out. But that Marta Dubray, who is basically using Jack, also they're hooking up. I feel like this is maybe I'm wrong about this, but I can't think of another book of mysteries that I had read at this point where someone had two sexual partners.
That's true. Yeah.
And it's a very weird thing, but when I was reading it, I was like, huh, that's kind of progressive, maybe? Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah. And the only problem is they don't know about each other.
No, well, that's a huge problem.
Yeah. but also, I feel like Jack, looking at mirroring, Jack is the person Hastings wants to be.
Oh, 1,000,000%.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yep. Jack has the romantic life of Hastings' dreams. So that's also kind of like she's dragging that in front of him a little bit or dangling it in front of him.
And you're also right, though, because like Jack is doing this, I wouldn't say it was on the sly as much as he's just having these two separate relationships. But that said, we get to really see those relationships from the women characters' point of view.
That's true.
Yeah, which is really cool. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I just love that the rich woman ends up being the interloper. And it's really the like scrappy queen of the stage that ends up getting his heart.
The true love has nothing to do with the money. Yeah, it's so excellent. So chapter 11 starts right where chapter 10 ended. Stoner is completely surprised at what Mademoiselle Renaud has said about there being an affair. And then all of a sudden, her son returns. Jack bursts in.
Everybody's like, wait, aren't you supposed to be in either Cherbourg or like on your way to South America? And luckily, his ship to South America was delayed because of engine trouble. He saw about his father's death in the newspaper, and he, like, ran back to Merlinville. Also, I have to say, I think I had this somewhere else, but, like, Monsieur Renaud was willing to send his son on a kind of just pointless journey, but I want to just really go into detail about how extensive this fake journey is. Mm-hmm. He was going to send his son on a steamer, not to somewhere like maybe on a eastern coast of South America. He's sending him to Buenos Aires. And then he's like, you have to cross the Andes on your own. I'm imagining like, is this by train? Is this by car? Is there a wagon involved at some point?
Like probably donkeys, my guess.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. All to go to Santiago to then learn that there is no reason for him to be there. I just feel like he could have sent him to New York. He could have sent him even to like a different continental country.
Mm-hmm. He could have sent him anywhere.
Send him to England because like he also had a house and a business in England. Do not send your son over an ocean and mountain range.
He is doing this to keep Jack out of the way.
So he's not suspected.
To me, there's a little bit of this like, you haven't had it rough, kid. Oh, so I'm going to send you on this incredible. Now, it could also just be because that makes for sure that he's going to be incommunicado for a very long time.
Yeah, exactly.
Which might be the big part of it too. But I just felt also the way that the whole trip through the Andes and all that stuff. I was like, that sounds very much like a, you know, back in my day, we had to walk to school in 14 feet of snow. And if we were 5 minutes late, then, and it just felt like this very sort of fatherly thing to toughen up the son.
Yeah, like I crossed the Andes to seek out my fortune, and so must you, especially after like their big argument. And that also takes him away from Mar.
Yes.
It ensures that she can't touch him. So I guess, but still I'm like, amazing. What a journey. And he kind of explains like kind of the origins of this trip, that he received a telegram, an urgent telegram from his father that was mysterious, saying him going to Santiago was a matter of the utmost importance. So without questioning it, he just goes. Mm-hmm. World War One is still lingering in the background. And we learn that Jack, I think this is supposed to tell us, not only does this create the reason for the commemorative knives, we learn that there are three special commemorative knives to like commemorate his service or whatever. I think this is supposed to tell us that like Jack is an upstanding guy. I think we learn that he actually faked his age to be able to serve in the war. So I think we're supposed to think of him as very like valiant. He is a hero. He is a young war hero. And so I think that makes it even more upsetting when he ends up becoming wrongfully imprisoned. And so, yeah, Madame Renaud says something mysterious that kind of hints at the fact that all of this was fabricated and she was in on it. She says, "You didn't sail. After all, it doesn't matter now." Oh, so mysterious. As you said, Giraud is really like closing in on him, and he asks Jack about the argument. And we learned that Jack had said, "We like, when you're dead, I'll do as my please." And his dad replied, "But I'm not dead yet." And Jack says, "I wish you were."
Yeah.
Just exerted. That sounds really sketchy, but really it's about marrying who he wants to marry. I love this little moment afterwards. Otay is like, "Well, what were you arguing about?" And Jack is like, he's kind of, I think he's trying to like protect Marthe. And Poirot calmly and quietly is like, "I know what they were arguing about. They were arguing about Mademoiselle Marthe Dubray." And everybody's like, "What?" And then, you know, kind of backing up Poirot right away and his instincts, Jack says, "Yeah, I wanted to marry her. And my dad was really mad." And they ask Madame Renaud if she knew. And she's like, "Yeah, I was really worried about it." And Jack is like, "You too, Mom. You were against me too." And this is where we get the great line. Madame Renaud says to her son, Jack, "You should not marry someone who has a mother of doubtful antecedents." Madame Renaud knows that Madame Dubray is not who she says she is. And that it's not just, "We don't know this woman's past." She's like, "I know this woman's past, and she's really sketchy." So,
yes, but also so is my husband.
Yeah, I know. Everyone is sketchy. Everyone is telling a secret, and Jack is in love. So anyways, back to this little scene where Jack is just like, just adding to the chaos. Okay, so they show the letter that Bella wrote, because they're kind of like, "Well, what about this?" And Jack says he...
And this was found in the pocket of Paul Renaud's coat. The coat Paul Renaud was wearing when his body was found.
That's actually Jack's. Jack is like, "I don't know who wrote it." And he acts really scandalized. And then Otay is asking about the murder weapon. And he's like, "It was so small." And so Jack asks to see it. And then, uh-oh. Monsieur Bex comes in and he's like, "Oh no, the dagger is missing from the shed. We know it's because Cinderella has stolen it because Hastings was a dum-dum." Hastings, gotta love him. So he's like, "Oh, that's so weird. The dagger was there this morning." And everybody's like, "This morning? What were you doing in the shed, Hastings?" And so he explains. And then all of the puffed up preening his feathers that he did that morning of like, "Look at how important I am. Look at how cool I am." Everybody is like, "Hastings, you are really dumb." And Otay is like, "You know, like, this is bad behavior, but I bet she was young and beautiful, so it's okay." And Monsieur Bex is like, "No, he's not as forgiving." And he gets Hastings to admit that the shed had been unlocked for a 20-minute window. And Giraud, ever the positive man here, is like, well, that's actually not that bad because we know that the killers must have been near the house then. And that means that they're still close by and we can catch them.
But the thing that's so cool about this, I mean, a lot of the things are so cool about this, but it's so interesting how everyone is looking at the wrong thing, which is that Hastings brought this woman there and left her there. And they have so little regard for her.
Yes. Yeah.
That the fact that it was open for 20 minutes now makes sense to the plot.
Yeah.
Because now it gives the detectives to say like, oh, well, the assassins must still be in the area. And that's when they stole the knife, when the door was open for those 20 minutes. But instead, it was the woman who was in with the body, of course, which they're all overlooking.
They are victims of their own lack of imagination. They're going to learn a lesson out of this, that ladies can do a lot of things.
Yes.
That they can't do. And maybe even save the day in the end. Kind of at the end of these exchanges, everybody's like, well, I guess that's it for the day. Let's all go home. And on the way out, as Hastings and Poirot are leaving, Poirot gets out a measuring tape and he measures the overcoat hanging on the coat rack. And he lets out a satisfied grunt. I can't even do that. Like, ha. Huh. Yeah. And that's where we end.
I think really the thing that's most interesting about chapter 12 is in a lot of ways, is the title. The chapter is called Poirot Elucidates Certain Points. And that is so much more specific than Giraud Finds Some Clues.
So true. And I hadn't really put those next to each other. And yes, it's such a like little slight to Giraud. They're walking back to town and Hastings is feeling really frustrated. And he decides on this walk, he's like, I'm going to think about all the things that I've just encountered, and I'm going to try to figure it out. And Poirot is very sweet in this moment, and he can tell what Hastings is feeling. He can tell that Hastings is frustrated. And this is where I think we get this little like showing actually who Poirot is deep down. He does care about Hastings, and he's like, we're not in the crime scene anymore. I'm going to take some time to like indulge your frustration a little bit. And so Poirot is like, what are you thinking about? Hastings tells him that he thinks Madame Renaud is holding something back. And Poirot's like, good job. Yeah, like I suspected that. I think she is. And we get this really cute little exchange between Hastings and Poirot. And Poirot's like, the wristwatch, Hastings, the wristwatch. Again, the wristwatch. Poirot was eyeing me curiously. You see, mon ami, you comprehend? No, I replied with some ill humor. So we get like gorgeously cranky Hastings too, which I love. I neither see nor comprehend. You make all these confounded mysteries and it's useless asking you to explain. You always like keeping something up your sleeve to the last minute. And Poirot replies, do not enrage yourself, my friend, Poirot said with a smile. I will explain if you wish, but not a word to Giraud, c'est entendu? Which means like, do you understand me? Are you listening? He treats me as an old one of no importance. So Poirot says, let us employ our little gray cells and let's kind of go over everything. Hastings is like, we've got to get to the train station to see if people saw two foreigners. And Poirot says something really great. He's like, you don't believe that rigmarole, which is such a great word. Clearly, the foreigners are made up. Hastings is like, I don't understand. And Poirot again is like, this is a crime from the past. And then Hastings is like, but what about the secret? What about Santiago? And Poirot is like, nothing's going to come out of Santiago. Let it go. It is a red herring. And then really like the last kind of thing that we get is that Poirot thinks that Madame Renaud is shielding someone with her lies, which is absolutely true. She is protecting her husband. And then he says, there is something very deep underneath this. So again, we get this sense that like we've only scratched the surface, which is why I think it was also hard for both of us to read, is because we're like, we are halfway through the book at this point. How can we barely be scratching the surface when we have just gone through this like thicket of clues?
Although problem is that then when you go back and read it again, you're like, oh, I could have seen that if I would have really taken a look at it. So it's really ingenious.
Yeah. I mean, it's so much more pleasant on the second read because you have all the context. And yeah, when you don't, it's a little frustrating.
So let's go from chapter 12, I believe, unless my mind is totally messed up. Numerically next is chapter 13. Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, I just want to make sure.
And we get the girl with the anxious eyes.
So chapter 13, the girl with the anxious eyes, starts at lunchtime with Hastings and Poirot.
Poirot loves a lunchtime. He and Hastings are always having lunch. Hastings tells a story about Cinderella. Poirot is like, that's very romantic. He kind of chides Hastings in a very cute way. Poirot says, "Tiens, a story of the most romantic. What is her name, this charming young lady?" And Hastings is like, "Well, I don't really know yet." Poirot's like, "You've met her twice." But he says, "Still more romantic. The first rencontre on the train from Paris, the second one, journeys end in lovers' meetings. Is it not the saying?" And Hastings is like, "Don't be an ass, Poirot." And then he really calls him out. He says, "Yesterday it was Mademoiselle Dubray. Today it is Mademoiselle Cinderella." Decidedly. And he basically says, "You should establish a harem."
Right.
Hastings is like, "I don't want to see her again because she got me in so much trouble and she was so weird about like the crime scene." Again, she's so weird because she's doing the exact same thing that he's doing, but she's a lady. Poirot, as much as he's like, "Let's have a little banter," he just plays Hastings so easily here. He's like, "Can you remind me the name of the hotel she's staying at?" And he like names a random hotel. And Hastings, obviously not thinking, has to correct him and gives him the name of her hotel.
It's exactly what Cinderella does to him.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, have we kind of talked about how like Hastings ends up with basically a female Poirot?
Right. Yeah. Right. With, I think, more upper body strength. But yes,
exactly. Yes. If Poirot were an acrobat, then he is fated to like be just around people who know more about what's going on than him.
Yeah, I think so. And he can go through life that way because of the privileges that he has because of his gender at the time and also race.
Yeah.
Frankly. So that's
his fate, is everybody. Yes. He is just going to be ignorant, going around thinking he's better than everyone while he's getting duped constantly.
Yeah. And showing women that he's interested in corpses to impress them.
Yeah. It's a great first date. When Poirot can't remember the name of the hotel, Hastings is like, "Poirot, he's so weird. He can't remember anything we talked about." And Poirot is just like innocently slicing his bread into neat squares, which I think is so funny because like Hastings just has no idea what's going on. And then Poirot is just like, "Oh, BTW, I'm going to Paris. I'm going to Paris. The murderer isn't in Paris, but like there's some information I need to get." And so he tells Hastings to watch Giraud and to get to know Jack. "Please do not come with me. Your job is here, watching these two people and getting to know them." And of course, Hastings is so dejected. So he just literally like wanders listlessly around the beach. Maybe he runs into you.
Almost certainly.
Yeah. And I just can see him like kind of kicking sand.
Right. Yeah. Hastings, this part of the book, is like, "I saw this tall man with long hair and a beard. And then he put his hand on my shoulder. And then I woke up further down the beach and I looked and I saw that there was only one set of footprints."
Oh my God. This is getting to me. We're like transcending time, space, and dimensions.
Because I carried you, Hastings. Literally. That's all that happened. There's no religion. I just carried you. That's what you passed out.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like too much wine at the lunch.
Too much wine and too much rejection from Poirot.
I know. Yeah. So he's just wandering. Okay, I love the way his mind works. He's like, "I really don't want to see Cinderella again because, she sucks. So I should probably go talk to her so she knows to not bother me ever again."
Logic is 100% sound right there.
But also, like, she clearly doesn't want to see him because she hasn't told him her real name, nor did she give him the name of the correct hotel, which we soon learn. So he, like, can't find her at the hotel. He wanders around. He's probably looking super weird. And so he asks a concierge at the hotel, like, he describes her because he doesn't know her name. And the guy starts, like, smirking. And he's like, "That is so weird. Someone just came in describing the exact same woman." And Hastings is like, "Well, you described to me the person who was asking this. And he was like, he was a small gentleman, well-dressed, very neat, very spotless, the mustache very stiff, the head of a peculiar shape, and the eyes green. And so Hastings is like, Poro! God damn it! And then he's like, why would she give me the name of the wrong hotel? Like, did she do that on purpose? Did she not want to see me? So then he's even more like beach sulky. He can't even walk around. He's just sitting.
Beach sulky.
Yeah. So he's sulking. And I think he's sulking now by the house. Isn't that it? Oh, yeah. So he like goes back to the house and he's like, I'm still in a bad mood, but let me at least be in a bad mood by a crime scene. So he sits on a bench, kind of, again, in this like neutral zone where he's like by the golf course. So he's not just like, you know, trespassing, but also he's next to these two adjoining estates.
Yeah, it's kind of this magic shrubbery, tall, like one of those English ones that's like as tall as a person. In my mind's eye, he's sitting like on like a concrete bench on one side of it. And then on the other side, a conversation is taking place.
He hears Jack and Marthe talking, and Jack assures Marthe that they can get married now and that the last obstacle to their relationship has been removed. And then Marthe says, I'm worried for you. She gets her anxious eyes, because I think at this point, Hastings is not sitting on the bench anymore. He's like peering through the bushes. And so that definitely throws suspicion on Jack. Hastings, he is self-reflective. He gets a little embarrassed because he's like, this is so weird. I'm like watching these people through these hedges. Then he sees, this is one of my favorite things, he sees an odd brown dead shrub. And then he realizes that's not a shrub at all. It's Shiro. So like everybody is snooping and spying on everybody between these hedges. And so Shiro is like, he literally is like, how dare you? You interrupted my snooping. Where is your old fossil? And he means Poro. And then Hastings is like, oh, he went to Paris. And he gets a little uneasy. He's like, why is Poro in Paris? And so Hastings, he goes back to the hotel next day. He's at breakfast. And his wit, and I love that like all this whole story is punctuated by like French resort meals, which I imagine are just like incredible. And you're like by the sea. And I just love it. I feel like Hastings is living his best life there. And the waiter is like, oh my God, did you hear what happened at Villa Genevieve? There's been another murder. So he just like throws his croissant down. He rushes back to the house. Francoise is outside just like, the house is cursed. The house is cursed. People keep getting killed here. And she says a stranger has been killed, but he was killed in the shed with the same knife as Monsieur Renaud. That's where we end this chapter. Mega cliffhanger, mega jaw-dropping moment, which again, if we are like ramping up from the previous four chapters, this is exciting.
I don't usually partake in this heavy French food, but it is making me a little sleepy. I do not know how these detectives and all these people do all this work after eating at the resort. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I think we should probably pause and take a little snoozeroo, take a little nap.
Really good idea. And, you know, like seriously, mad props to Hastings for eating that like that and then running to the Villa Genevieve. Yeah. My goodness.
They left out his like side cramp.
Right, they did. And also the fact that he threw the croissant down and then thought better of it and picked it up and finished it.
And was like, nobody saw that, right?
Right, never. It's fine. It's fine. Yes, that's a great idea. Let's retire to our hotel rooms and just kind of nap, and then we'll get right back to it with the next episode. Does that sound good?
That sounds amazing.
Where should I meet you?
I think we have to meet at the beach this time.
Oh, great idea. Excellent. Yeah. You know, actually, I take it back. You have a hotel room. I sleep at the beach. Yeah, I know. You'll just come down. I'll have a little like thing set up. It'll be fine. It'll be
and I can imagine that I'm like having a lovely meal on some kind of patio looking out over the beach and the sea. And I can just see you in your little book hovel.
Right. It's exactly the book hovel. Yeah, that's exactly. It's exactly right.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I'll see you there.
Yes. Okay. Bye.
Right, bye.